Okay, so Sean, what about in the Southern District of New York? Do you, and certainly not every decision, I'm not suggesting that, but do you
talk to the other judges about this? So we don't actually have as much time to talk as you would think, right? We're in the same building, but everybody's doing their job. So if I was asking somebody to do my job with me, they couldn't do their job. Mm-hmm. So you sort of, it happens in things where you've got real tough decisions, and you have experienced colleagues who have some wisdom, and people are always incredibly deferential. But what you're looking for is the insight, right? So you can reach different conclusions, getting back to the earlier question about different results. What you're really worried about as a judge is missing something, right? There was a flaw in my reasoning, or there's an argument I didn't fully deal with or give sort of a full weight to it. And so that's where it can be very helpful. And so, so we do talk to each other, and it is very helpful. People have never told me anything about how to rule, but if I couldn't rip off the good wisdom of my colleagues, this job would be impossible, frankly. So, the other comment I'd have on this is that I was concerned and remained vigilant about not being somebody who does things different just to do something different, right? It's not a benefit to the bar to say, well, that judge just likes to do it the way he or she likes to do it. If I've got a different take on the law and the facts and I think it's supported, great. But at the same time, I sometimes will, particularly, so we're talking about consumer issues, so it'll be more like, how do you deal with this thing, issue? Because it may be as much about the substantive law as about the process. And so I think it's important for judges to be considerate of the bar that way, so that if you have differences, they're meaningful differences based on something substantive, as opposed to, well, I just thought that was the way to do it, and I'm doing it that way because I'm doing it that way. I remember being on the other side of the podium on those things. And so, for example, when I have people come in adversaries and talk about discovery, I always try to give them a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to what I do, because I know they're dealing with a bunch of judges who all have different views about discovery. And I remember dealing with the judge in a complicated tax shelter case who said, 3 months, doesn't matter. Discovery overseas, 3 months, everything's 3 months. So you all don't know what we're doing. So again, my view is to try to give you the information you need, but also just try to not make meaningless or just form over substance kinds of distinctions.
I also tell you, and about once a year, for example, and this isn't the only example, Judge Davis and I will call each other. And, you know, I might, you know, call him and say, you wrote this opinion that says this. I've got something similar. It's not the same. You know, what do you think of this? Because I know he's always thought about it. Those are more rare than talking to, you know, Chris, because Chris happens to get in the office really early in the morning like I do. And so, you know, that it's pretty easy to have that conversation. But, I mean, I will tell you that, you know, if I call a fellow judge, it doesn't matter who in the country it is. And I know I picked on Tony for a moment. But I could call Sean, who I met today. And it doesn't matter who you call. The protocol is you return that call within 5 minutes, right? I mean, you get right back to your fellow judge. There's a reason why they're calling you. They're not calling to waste your time. And I think we all cooperate in terms of giving people thoughts without control. And I think that's a universal trait. But hopefully you've never felt imposed on when I call you, right? And it's just part of what we do.
Agreed. Well, let's move on to a different topic. So let's talk about defense costs. So this is the question. So an attorney for a Chapter 11 debtor files a retention application with an engagement letter signed by the debtor that obligates the estate to pay defense costs for defending its fee applications. So here we are in the post-DeSarco Baker Botts world. Judge Lane, what happens?
Well, again, I apply the law, right? So so what's the law? What kind of objection have you gotten? How well thought out is the objection? The other thing you might do, sometimes you do in these sort of circumstances, if you're you're saying, well, you want a blind right. Why can't you make it? You are permitted to ask for fees as opposed to some automatic grant of fees. Because judges always like to understand cases and controversies in the real world. Nobody likes the get-out-of-jail-free card and to sort of make these predictions into the future. I have no powers of prediction. If I did, I'd be retired. I'd own my own island. I'd be running the Mets much better than they're being run. I don't have predictions, so I like data. I like factual circumstances. So that's something that would inform my response to this.
So I've not been in this position because the United States Trustee's Office in Southern District of Texas always raises the objection for me, right? I think if I had, I don't know what I would do for sure, but what I might do is hold a hearing on it and ask why is that allowed under ASARCO, really so that if somebody else missed it, they can raise an objection, and then try and learn whether, I don't know whether it's allowed under ASARCO or not. I mean, let me just start with that. So for those of you that haven't read this, ASARCO says that the costs of defending a fee aren't authorized by the statute itself, but it leaves open the question of whether you could have a contract that authorizes the payment of fees for defending your fees. I think that's right. A fair summary of it. And so the law is ambiguous on the question. And I think my only thing I would want to do is not do it by accident and try and have an opportunity to think about it.